Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and with Amazon Prime Video UK, the home of the US Open in the UK. That's what it's going to be in just a few weeks' time when the US Open gets underway. We come to you right now from Wimbledon because we are just coming towards the conclusion of the event here, and we are taking this opportunity to take your questions in the company of our executive producer, Melanie Bowes, who is choosing the very best of the questions. Well, certainly the one she likes, that you've all sent in for Catherine Whittaker and myself, David Law. So, Catherine, shall we get underway? Are you ready for this test?
Ready as I'll ever be.
I'm a bit scared.
Hang on, it's a test.
I think
frame it as a test.
I think we
David.
Do get marked at the end of it. Yeah, we get a grade, everything. Anyway, we'll start with somebody who calls themselves Nadal True. Goat.
Oh, really? My alarm bells start ringing when people have tennis player names in their social media handles.
Yeah, but this is Melanie Bowes who's chosen it. So
yeah,
you know,
there's going to be an angle here, I rather suspect.
Would you believe goat comes up in the actual question?
Oh,
yeah, as well. So the question is, what more does Nadal has to achieve to be widely considered the greatest of all time? He has already achieved a lot, and he's 5 years younger than Roger Federer. Well, as we sit here right now, he has just been beaten by Novak Djokovic in the semi-finals, an absolute classic of a match. Semi-finals of Wimbledon, so he's not going to be winning an 18th Grand Slam title here, but, you know, he's still going strong.
He is. He will win more Grand Slam titles. How many remains to be seen? For me, the simplest answer for that question is to match or better Roger Federer's Grand Slam total. Because I think if he matches it, if they're even on Grand Slams, I at that point would probably go to the Olympic gold medal. The after Grand Slam titles, that's probably what I'd go to. I know Roger Federer has one in doubles, but we're looking at singles prowess here. So if you're looking at things to choose between them, that would be, like you go to goal difference and then you go to goals scored and then you go to fair play record or whatever it is. My next thing after, I try and do these things as scientifically as possible, because otherwise you're in dodgy, murky, treacherous territory. The Olympic gold would be my decider at that point. But I know a lot of people think that you should try and weight it in favour of Nadal because he only has one Grand Slam played on his favourite surface. But then you could make the same argument for Federer. And okay, hard courts maybe on paper suit him a bit better. But I don't know. Again, I think you're getting into such unscientific territory there. That for me it would go to, I mean, hey, Roger Federer could win Olympic gold in Tokyo 2020.
Yes.
I suspect he would like to have a go at it, because I suspect somewhere very, very deep in the Roger Federer psyche that niggles like a tiny, tiny bit, especially given that he couldn't play Rio. But that would be my attempt to answer the unanswerable question.
Does the head-to-head come into play for you at all? Obviously, it's still heavily weighted in favour of Rafael Nadal, although Roger Federer has won about the last four.
It would be quite far down. It would probably be even with fair play record on the sort of decisive factor. I'm not saying it's irrelevant, but for me it wouldn't be one of the key indicators of who were greater, because tennis is all about matchups. What you're saying that, I don't know, I'm trying to think of one of tennis's weird, quirky matchups. I was having this conversation with a writer for the ATP, James Bedell, the other day. I know one of the weird tennis matchups is Dominic Thiem against Kevin Anderson. Like, Thiem just can't beat Kevin Anderson. He's never beaten him. There are weird things like that, but you don't then say, well, I mean, you might say, but not on that basis, that, oh, well, Kevin Anderson's definitely a far better player than Dominic.
He's having a better career.
He is. Bad example, David. Think of a quirky head-to-head for me.
No, I can't.
They do exist. Marat Safin and Fabrice Santoro.
Yeah, there you go. There's a good one. Very good. Yes, Santoro dominated Safin, but Safin, had the better career.
So for me, not irrelevant, but not one of the key indicators. Mm. What about for you?
Yes, I think you're probably right. I think I would probably agree with that. He's also, has he won more Davis Cup titles? I don't know whether
I think they both have the one.
I think he,
he's
I think
not
Nadal's
won as many
couple,
year end. He's not won the so he's not won the ATP finals.
No, but again, that's maybe on his least favourite.
It is on his least favourite surface. But then, would you? Some would perhaps have that ahead of Olympic gold. I don't know. For me, I'd put the Olympic gold, the fact that it's every 4 years. That's not on his... That's never been on his favourite surface either. So, yeah.
Honestly, I think if they ended on the same number of Grand Slam singles titles, I'd probably just call it a draw.
I'd love that. It should be a draw, maybe.
You know, the greatest goats of all time.
And I know, again, some people might point to the fact that Nadal's had to struggle more, he's had more injury, but then it's not entirely accidental that Federer's had so few injuries. That is part of his greatness, his schedule and body management. I'm not saying he hasn't had a fair slice of luck as well, but haven't all the greats at some stage and in some respect? So
yeah, I'd probably say, in answer to your question, Nadal true goat, that Nadal has to end up with more slam titles ultimately.
I wonder what Nadal true goat thinks about the matter.
I'm really on the border here. I don't know. It could go either way. But anyway, Rosin says, it's generally known that
Roisin,
tennis...
Roisin, isn't it? Is it R-O-I-S-I-N?
Oh, go on then.
I think it's Roisin.
Yeah, sorry about that, Roisin. She says, it's generally known that tennis was dominated by big serves in the 90s, but why was there never a situation like the Anderson-Isner semi-final where it also went really deep into the fifth, back in the days when we had all those big serves? Is it different racket technology? Are players fitter and can play longer now, or something else? I don't think it hasn't happened.
I think we're looking at an anomaly here and trying to decipher patterns from an anomaly is not really doable.
If you go back 30, 40 years where there were no tie breaks in any sets at all. You had a lot of sets that were 18, 16 and things like that. I think the one difference in terms of sheer length of time on a court is that everybody was serving volleying. So all points were lasting 3, 5, 7 strokes, not 40.
Ben Rothenberg today, he's using the recent events as pretty potent ammunition in his campaign for best of three sets at the Slams in men's tennis. I respect the relentlessness of his campaign. It is Nadal-esque. But he points to the fact that when best of five set tennis was decided as the best format for men's tennis, best of five set matches took under an hour, and tennis has evolved so much, you know, not obviously in the last 100 years, but just in the last 10 years, you know, thinking about that 5-hour 53-minute Australian Open final, you know, when they were deciding that men should play best of five sets at Slams, no one was thinking that could end up in 5-hour 53-minute matches. Hey, I'm still a believer in best of five sets, with caveats and with adjustments. I certainly would make adjustments. I think you would too, David. But there were long matches. There were long matches. There were, okay, there wasn't a 26-24, but that just happens to have been a bit longer than some of the long ones there were in the 90s. I don't know. You remember the 90s more clearly than I do, David.
I do that for sure. 1992, Stefan Edberg won three successive five-set matches to win the US Open, and then a four-set match. He beat Richard Krajicek from a breakdown. He beat Ivan Lendl over five, and then he beat Michael Chang in a match well over 5 hours. And he still managed to make it back the next day to beat Pete Sampras in four. So, and that was with tiebreaks in the fifth set. So, you know, it's not like there were not long matches. Mats Wilander and I think John McEnroe played each other for over 6 hours in the Davis Cup. It has happened. I know what you mean, Roisin, but I think it's more a question of those rallies just being that much shorter, so that most of the five-set matches just didn't last as long.
Yeah.
And, look how long these guys take between points as well.
I think that's a factor. Absolutely, I think that's a factor. In the 90s, they were pretty quick. You know, we discuss Nick Kyrgios as being a throwback, don't we? Because he's so quick between the points. I remember how quick, I know Roddick wasn't technically the 90s, but he was so quick between points. I'd agree with that. I do think it's become more of an endurance sport. You do have to be fitter now than ever before. But yeah, I think more crucially, it's not like there weren't long matches in the 90s. We've just all perhaps erased them from our memories because they weren't as entertaining as the gruelling long matches that we have these days, perhaps.
Yes, fair point. Lee Tennis says, would tennis as a sport be better off with a single tennis commissioner?
Yes.
Right now, there's too many organisations involved, WTA, ATP, ITF, and both the players and the fans suffer.
Unequivocally, yes. I don't know whether Lee Tennis, who I suspect quite likes tennis, is talking about a single human being, a John McEnroe style.
You've got to get the right one.
Yeah.
I mean, they do it in other sports, don't they?
Do. Oh, David, there are dogs. There are dogs.
Yeah, there are dogs walking around on the Wimbledon roof.
I'm finding it distracting. I'm going to find it difficult to talk about tennis.
Let's nominate one of them as the commissioner. And
oh, they are
work.
Good dogs.
What defines a good dog? Is there such a thing as a bad dog?
No, there absolutely is not such a thing as a bad dog. But there are some dogs that I like.
If you
more
get
than
a really arsey dog.
They look like you could have a really good, long, meandering, fun walk with them, but then they'd also curl up on your lap afterwards.
There must be such a thing as a dog you don't like.
There's dogs I like less.
Right, okay.
Little yappy ones.
So, commissioners of tennis.
I think unequivocally, wholeheartedly, 1,000 times, yes, it would be better for the sport if there were a unified governing body acting in sync and in the greatest interest of tennis, of tennis fans, of tennis players, of tennis. I find it quite distressing, actually, to sometimes see the way the different bodies pull in different directions at the detriment of the sport as a whole. That is absolutely, I wouldn't expect them to do anything less, because they have their own remits and they will act in the best interest of their own remit. Of course they will. That's their raison d'etre. But it is to the detriment of the greater good of the sport. I don't see how it's going to change. Changing would involve relinquishing of power. And who's going to do that?
You would actually almost have to have all of the governing bodies, ITF, WTA, ATP, Grand Slams, all just decide to have sort of some amnesty of power and just throw it all in and say, we're going to give up all our rights and let's all agree we're going to start again. You know, it's
power
never
doesn't
going to
work
happen.
Like that, does
no,
it?
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
And I mean, which does make it fascinating to me as to how they got to that position in the NBA and the NFL, where you have a commissioner and it's that person who votes.
Well, that's the other thing, isn't it? I mean, nobody designed tennis to be structured like this administratively, did they? It's just sort of accidentally evolved this way. If you were starting from scratch, there is absolutely no way you would design the current administrative structure that we have. Nowhere in a million years. If someone handed in a proposal for you that you'd have an ITF that's in charge of Grand Slams, Davis Cup and Fed Cup, but actually each of the individual slams can also make quite a lot of their own decisions, and they sort of are unified but also sort of not. And then there'd be an ATP that represents both tournaments and tennis players, even though those two things are quite often in conflict. And you'd have the same on the women's tour, and there would be some joint events, but they would be run completely separately by the two tours, and then there'd be a third stream of the tournaments running them as well. I mean, no. No.
Did you
follow
all that?
You'd be laughed out of town if you walked in and gave a presentation proposing that as the best course of action. But here we are.
My mother, who doesn't really follow tennis that closely, but she's an absolutely avid tennis podcast listener. Can't think why. But she would listen to what you've just said, and she would have given up about 30 seconds in, because it just sounds
nonsense.
Yeah,
it's a camel. It's a camel, and we need a horse. A camel is a horse designed by committee.
Right. Yes, I'm with you now. Yeah. See, I also couldn't follow the line of thought, but now I get it. You see, as long as you make it very clear, Catherine, I'm with you. It is a problem because at the moment things are just getting stuck. We've got this situation with the World Team Cup, and we still don't know yet whether the ITF plans for their Davis Cup in year-end finale will be voted through, and it's. My fear is that we end up with just an unsatisfactory end result for the sport of tennis.
Well, this could have changed by the time you're listening to this, but the situation is that the last we heard from Chris Kermode, the chairman, executive chairman of the ATP, was he said it would be insane, madness, for both the ITF and the ATP to go ahead with their team tournament proposals. And then about a month later, the ATP go ahead and announce they're doing theirs, and then the ITF quickly have to respond and say, okay, well, we're doing ours too. And you just think,
and it's the players in that instance just thinking, well, yeah, we don't like this proposal, we want our own thing. So they've basically, I imagine, forced Chris's hand, and yeah. he has to back them.
Yeah, but it's individual interests, isn't it? You've got competing individual interests, and
very frustrating.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm an optimist. One day, maybe, it'll all change.
It's not going to change, is it?
Right. Catherine's taught
it's
me out of it.
It's not going to change.
You'll be delighted to know that Melanie Bowes has chosen a question from Pavi G.
Oh, boy.
Certainly Pavi G's delighted. And that question is, as Boris Becker walks past.
He just said ciao to us, David.
Did he?
Yeah.
Is that hello
He's
or goodbye?
He's a multilingual man. I believe it can be both.
Can it?
So it was like a hello, goodbye, I'm not going to stop to talk to you.
Okay, right. See you then, Boris. Ciao. Pavi G says...
Oh, Pavi. How has Pavi made it onto our podcast?
Well, he's got in with Melanie Bowes, and Bob's your uncle. Were you surprised at Shapovalov having such a poor grass court season? Which youngster impressed you most on grass? I have to say, I was surprised at Shapovalov having a poor grass court season, in as much as everybody knows, I think he's a fantastic player to watch. You have thought that even longer than I have, because you saw him play, I think, in early adopter.
Yeah, I was.
I'm trying to big you up, Catherine.
Thanks.
Don't gloat, all right? But yes, you spotted him before me. I accept that. And
I'm one of those people that's like, well, I had their first album.
Yeah, and I did notice you're about to say, well, I'm not that keen on him anymore. I think he is tailor-made for grass, really. You would think he is. And he has struggled. He's had maybe a couple of match wins on all the tournaments. He lost first round at Queens. I think he lost first round here against Benoit Paire.
Second round to Benoit Paire, yeah.
And he won the first set 6-love in that match. So, but at the same time, you've got to bear in mind the guy is, 19?
Yeah, he's 19.
So young. And yes, I know, Pavi G, you are constantly singing the praises of Tsitsipas, and you think that TFO is a better player than Shapovalov. Well, look, he might be a better player right now. I just don't think he's got anything like the potential of Shapovalov. Tsitsipas, I must say, I do.
Yeah, TFO I would put in the Kyle Edmund category. I think he has top 10 potential, and, you know, from the top 10, anything's possible. He could, you know, reach Grand Slam finals, maybe, you know, win one. I'm certainly not predicting that for him. He's an incredible athlete. I love the guy. I'd love to see him break through. He's got a funky style that's great to watch, but is error prone, I think. So yeah, I'd put him in the Kyle Edmund category of, not all of those specific things apply to Kyle Edmund. Put it this way, I'd be surprised if Kyle Edmund wins a slam, but...
That's a good question. Will Kyle Edmund win a slam?
I think he could, but I'm not predicting it at
this
stage.
He'll get to a final.
Yeah, I think he might too. I think he might be top 10 periods of his career. And I think the same may very well be true for Tiafoe. The potential of Denis Shapovalov is greater without question, and the potential of Stefanos Tsitsipas is greater. It doesn't mean they'll achieve it. I mean, Xavier Melis had great potential.
Yes.
But
do you think, though, that maybe, whilst I agree, I think he has greater potential, I think Shapovalov could win slams and be world number one, potentially. Do you feel, though, with his type of pretty flashy game, and I remember when I spoke to Leighton Hewitt about it on the podcast a few weeks back and asked him about him, you know, because I was hoping he would say how good he was. He said he was polite and he was complimentary, but he also said he's going to be a really flashy player. And it doesn't really go with Leighton Hewitt, does it, generally? Because Hewitt's the complete opposite of that. He's not a flashy player.
You could describe Roger Federer as a flashy player, though.
Well, you could, but this is why I think we're going to be at a junction here at some point.
Well, basically, the parallel to draw is Grigor Dimitrov, isn't it? Showtime is what Brad Gilbert calls him. He's got so many options at his disposal, and he too often goes for the flashiest one. I think that there is a fundamental chip missing in Grigor Dimitrov, which is that just quickest route to win points chip. It's the point construction, you know. Danny Valverde has tried to build it by analog means, you know, build in those repeatable patterns of play, those meet and drink ways to win points, but they're not digitally inbuilt. He doesn't have the instinct for it. I see more of it in Denis Shapovalov than I do in Grigor Dimitrov.
Yeah, he is an instinctive player, isn't he?
He is. There's a way to go, without question, but he is 19. In modern tennis terms, that is extraordinarily young, and it's only because of how rapidly and extravagantly he broke through that we've so quickly adjusted our expectations of him. And now, okay, we're having to row back a little bit, but I'm not predicting he's going to be one of the greatest ever, but I'd be surprised if he didn't win slams.
Yeah, and I also think he has an appetite for the sport which will keep him coming back for more each time.
And he's smart. Yeah. He's smart. From what I can gather, he seems really switched on and a learner. I'm not saying Grigor Dimitrov isn't those things. I just think that digital tennis chip is missing.
Where do I get one of those?
Yeah, if only they were available off the shelf.
Maybe Amazon, come to my rescue, given we are partners with you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Marchesa, I think that is.
Marchesa.
All right.
Well, if it's like the fashion label.
Marchesa.
The now discredited Dania. Fashion label.
I don't know, Catherine. I don't know about anything to do with fashion, as you well know. Anyway, this person wants to know, Did this year's Wimbledon demonstrate that it really is time that women should be playing best of five in the slams? There were some flat matches and others would have benefited from a longer format. Females are more than capable, and in my humble opinion, it is necessary and would end the prize money arguments once and for all.
I think we have, we're in a position of agreement. Well, I won't speak for you. My position is, I see it very simply now. I see one very clear best solution, and I believe it's a solution not just to the equality issue, but to a wide variety of issues, which is best of three in men's and women's up until the quarterfinals, best of five in men's and women's from quarterfinals onwards. Boom.
Yeah, I would agree. I think you have so many matches early on that best of five does tire people out and clog it all up. But best of three late on can result in duds. And we had two pretty dud semi-finals in the women's tournament this year, for instance, and then it ends up being just this stick to beat women's tennis with, doesn't it? Because Kevin Anderson and Djokovic won in 5 hours plus, so how can they get the equal prize money? Yeah, and well, there are loads of other examples.
Okay, but Kevin Anderson would have lost limply to Roger Federer in straight sets in the quarterfinals if they were playing best of three.
Yes,
and everyone would have talked about how one-sided that match was.
But that's why best of five late on in the women's game, in order to just remove nerves as a consideration, early nerves at least, so that you don't have matches lost before they've begun.
A good example that you brought up when we had Mary Carrillo on one of our daily Wimbledon pods this week was the Ostapenko-Kerber semi-final. I can't believe that she wouldn't have... She had found her feet in that match by the end, and as I discussed with Mary, it was only because Kerber had secured that double break. You know, Kerber knew at a set and three love what Ostapenko does at a set and three love up in big matches, you know, from the French Open final last year, and she made absolutely damn sure she got that double break. But she was right to make sure, because then came Ostapenko. She was coming. It was just too late. And had she had more time, that could have been a match without question. And we were denied that.
I remember saying the same after the 2013 final when Sabina Lisicki started coming back against Marion Bartoli, but she was too late. And I mean, I don't think Eugenie Bouchard ever would have come back against Petra Kvitova the way it was going. But it would have been nice to have seen just another set of it, just to absolutely make sure.
Really. Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, just to make sure, no doubts about it. Yeah,
and also just to remove the asterisk for some people that they hold against women's tennis, and to stop this debate.
Yeah,
I
object
to
there even being a debate. So,
yes. Okay. Yeah, well, we're all in agreement.
Yeah, we're agreed. Yeah, sorted. We sorted it, David.
Yeah, right.
One step at a time.
Is that passed now? Can we just crack on? DVD Smith, David Smith, I believe it is, says, do you think Jamie Murray's successes, he asks this on Instagram, do you think Jamie Murray's successes are underappreciated? He's won four Grand Slams in the 2.5 years, and he has helped Andy with the Davis Cup triumph, yet he has never made the Sport Personality of the Year nomination and gets a fraction of the coverage of the singles players.
I would say doubles in general is underappreciated. I think four doubles players, generally, I think the other doubles players would probably look at Jamie and think he probably does pretty well, attention and sponsorship-wise and all the rest of it, because of where he's from, because he has a home Grand Slam, because of who his brother is, because he did help us win a Davis Cup title. But without question, doubles is underappreciated. Doubles is in crisis right now, and the games are recognising that, the men's game in particular. I actually think men's doubles is in a lot more of a crisis than women's doubles is, and they're trying things.
I just don't know what you can do, because I've been working in tennis for 20 years, and I remember 20 years ago when I joined the ATP, they hired a chap whose sole responsibility was to kind of market doubles and figure out a way to put it, make it relevant. And that, I'm sure that person's efforts were very worthy and imaginative, and people have come up with all sorts of ideas, but it's never really happened. And you still don't get doubles matches scheduled on show courts at prime time unless somebody comes from the singles field and plays, and you still don't get it on the television enough. I mean, so I thought Sky have done a pretty good job over the last year or two.
They always show the Masters finals, don't they? And they show a lot of Jamie's matches.
They've done a decent job of it, but still, it still feels like it's just this kind of awkward pain in the arse, really, that it's there, and that shouldn't be what it's like. Because when you see a match, and I've seen a couple of mixed doubles matches here at Wimbledon, people are so engrossed when they're there. And when you think of the Davis Cup, they're the highlights of the ties most often.
Yeah, and it is particularly bizarre because doubles is the format of the sport that most participants play. The majority of tennis that's played, certainly in this country, is doubles. I hate playing doubles, incidentally.
Do you?
Yeah.
Oh, I quite like it now. Can we have a game of doubles?
No, because I hate it.
No, but I like it.
I know why you like it. You're exactly the sort of player that would like doubles.
Why?
All slicing and dicing and all, like, just flirting with the tennis ball. I just want to belt the thing.
Right.
Your partner doesn't tend to like it if you belt it out of the court,
no.
I've found.
No, I don't think we'd be a very good doubles partnership somehow. I'm not convinced it would work. I think you might get a bit irritated by me.
I'm surprised my parents are still together after some of our family mixed doubles matches. That's the closest I've ever seen them to a marital crisis.
I think the only way you can really make doubles relevant, I think there's two things. One is you'd have to change the game and make it so that it's a combined ranking, and you know, players need to play doubles, if everybody had to play doubles, if they're just like, if it was Davies Cup, if you just couldn't play tennis unless you played doubles as well, then that would change, because you'd get lots of singles players playing it and all these big names, and you'd develop one. The problem is you'd put doubles players out of a job. That's the danger. And the other thing is, I think everybody's responsible for it. We all kind of look at each other as if to say, well, how come doubles isn't getting any coverage? And yet, do we give it enough coverage?
No, we don't. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I do feel on slightly sticky territory when I'm... Although I think it misses the wider point. When I'm sticking up for equality and everything, when people say, what about doubles? What about the wheelchair events then? Shouldn't they get equal prize money? And certainly for the wheelchair events, I find it particularly hard to argue against that. I don't think the answer to that is to doubt women's right to equality, but I do think there is something to be looked at there, for sure. Yes. And, you know, with prize money comes incentive, comes caring. You know, the only question mark I have over sort of assuming that the answer to the doubles crisis is to get more top players playing is that I don't think it's that great a look for doubles or for sport in general to have people doing it, you know, for a bit of fun on the side. I want to watch sport where people care, where, you know, they feel like their life is on the line.
But they do in Davis Cup.
They do.
Because they make it an integral part of the whole sport, and the point of the sport.
You're absolutely right, but I think what they've tried to do, they've tried a few things to try and incentivise top players.
To make it more convenient.
More convenient and all of that,
but
and I feel like all that's done is make them sort of every now and then just stick their name into a doubles draw, knowing they'll lose first round, you know, just to get a bit of extra match practice on a new surface or whatever, and I don't think that actually does doubles any favours. And I suspect it probably riles the week in, week out doubles players. We're in agreement again, David.
Blimey. Well, let's try something else. Two more questions here. Both of them from Melanie Bowes, our executive producer.
Our extraordinarily psychic, tennis intuitive executive producer. I don't know. I don't. She knows things, David.
She's like that octopus.
She is the Paul the octopus of the tennis podcast world, of the tennis world,
the predicting world.
She claims last year was some sort of fluke, and yet here she is, 2018. Top of the pile.
Doing it again. She says, I have a question about what you thought about Andy Murray's commentary and pundit slot for the BBC. Do you think it's something he could consider when he retires? And, you know, is he going to be a commentator or a coach? I mean, I think he well could be both.
Yep, agreed.
I don't see him going to every tournament and slogging around being a commentator all the time. But I do feel that he will be here at Wimbledon in the future, and I think he will probably do more of it as time passes, probably on the side of being a coach. I definitely think he'll be a coach.
Yeah, I think so too. I think his brain is too tuned into the tennis wavelength. He's too much of a student of the game to stay away. A bit like Leighton Hewitt. I don't think it'll be in the playing sense in quite the same way, but Hewitt just, I mean, he does do punditry and commentary, and he just can't, you feel like if he steps more than 6 feet away from tennis, like his nerves start twitching. That's an extreme example, but I do think Murray will be the same to an extent. I think he enjoys talking about tennis.
He enjoys arguing.
He enjoys arguing,
He enjoys proving people wrong and having statistical evidence with which to do it. He enjoys making you look just ever so slightly silly by very clever, quick put downs.
What I found particularly interesting about him, I mean, it didn't surprise me at all that he was a good pundit, because that's kind of just being interviewed, isn't it? And he's spent his whole life being interviewed, and I think he's a very, very good interviewee. In terms of the commentary, I am not a fan of the three commentators in a box thing. I know it's trendy and you know, it's hard to argue with having, you know, John McEnroe and whoever it might be, Kim Clijsters or whatever. The more Grand Slams in a box, the better. But I personally don't think it works. I think one Kim Clijsters and one John McEnroe, you know, give them the space to say what they want to say. It really worked with Andy Murray because he wanted to argue with the other, as it was at the time, Tim Henman. He wanted to bounce off him. He wanted to compete with Tim also in a gentle way.
He's also a naturally...
I thought he made the three-way commentary work.
He's quite a naturally curious person. And I think he shares this in common with Roger Federer to some degree. But I've sometimes been in situations with Andy Murray, and I don't know him well. I sort of always... He's always very polite, and we get along fine, but I've not spent huge amounts of time with him at all. And yet, I've sometimes found myself in locker rooms and player lounges, sitting on my own, minding my own business, and he will be sitting nearby on his own, minding his own business, and then I'll suddenly find he just asks me something out of the blue. And I'm not sort of expecting that. And it's just because something's occurred to him and he's curious how something might work in the media or what I might have thought of, I don't know, a situation with a player or whatever it might be. And he wants to know, he just wants to know people's opinions. It's not about me. It's not like, oh, David Law matters. It's just, so I'm there. And I've seen him do that with you when you've sat down to interview him and he's asked you two or three questions about who you're working for and what that's like and where you're going to be next week and things like that.
Yeah, I remember at the French Open last year, this really stuck with me. I was interviewing him after a match, would have been an early round match, first or second round, and it was the day that that thing had happened with the French Eurosport reporter that got... groped really on air by a French player, Mali Thomas, and it was all really, really unpleasant, and it made news over here as well. Obviously there's been the Chris Gayle thing, you know, there'd been a bit of a spate of them, and it was very topical and caught quite a lot of attention, and Murray had obviously read about it or something, or seen a news alert about it or whatever in the locker room, and he was asking me all about it, what I thought about it. He wanted to know whether it had ever happened to me. Usually, I mean, a tennis player or sports person of any kind would want to steer away from that kind of topic. as quickly as possible. But he was so curious about it. And he's curious. That's the conclusion.
Hmm. Final question on this particular listener's questions special with executive producer Melanie Bowes. Her final question is from her dad, actually. She says, he's a big tennis fan, but doesn't have the first clue about podcasting, never mind the tennis podcast. No offence intended. His question is, Catherine, what's her background? How did she get into tennis commentary? Because he remembers me over the years. I've been around a bit longer than Catherine, hence the grey hair. But Catherine seems relatively new to the scene to him.
New to the scene. It's good, isn't it?
You're on part of a scene. Awesome.
Oh, my goodness. Where to start with this? This feels a bit self-indulgent. Tune out now if you have no interest in my professional background. So I got a job as an intern in a press office at Queen's in the end of my year abroad from university. I finished my year abroad a little bit early and I thought, what can I do? And I thought, goodness me, that sounds like something I'd like to do. Applied for it and got it and met David Law. We didn't work together that much that week, but I knew that he was sort of the guy to try and get in with. And long story short, David gave me a bit of work experience. We ended up working together. I ended up working for David for a long time. And during that period, I had the chance to dip my toe, not even my whole toe, just the tip of my toe, really, into the broadcasting waters. I did quite a bit of interviewing and I loved that. And I remember David got me a few days of work experience with Five Live here at Wimbledon. 1 year, so I knew I liked it, but I didn't really know what to do with it or what my direction was. And then one day David says, we're going to start a tennis podcast, and I just sort of went along with it and thought, yeah, that's great. And there we were doing it, and there's a blip in the tail, which is where I sort of left tennis and decided I need to sort of satisfy my curiosity and try something completely different, and felt like I needed to know what a normal sort of 9-to-5 was like. So I left tennis and did that for 10 months. Turns out it was dreadful. but I spent that 10 months formulating my plan with the help of David, and sort of made me zero in, I guess, on exactly what elements of the job I liked most, and that was broadcasting. And luckily I'd built up enough contacts during my time, you know, working for David, doing mostly PR and communications in tennis, that a couple of people gave me a chance. And in fact, a couple of people that did give me that chance, it was as a result of hearing the podcast. So, yeah, big slice of luck, bigger slice of David Law's help, and a sort of quite a long period of figuring out precisely what it is I wanted to do, and making the most of opportunities, I guess. That's a very trite note on which to end that answer, and I'm sorry for talking about myself for 2 minutes, but you asked and there it is.
So there it is indeed. And that just about brings a close to our listener questions special for another episode. We will be back, of course, with further tennis podcasts over the course of the summer. Not exactly sure what will happen when, but we plan to be with you every single week all the way up to the US Open. And then, of course, daily throughout the US Open. We have been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, sponsored by Amazon Prime Video, the new home of the US Open in the UK, and the US Open getting closer all the time. We can't wait, but we'll have a little bit of a break first, you know, still bring you the pod, but we get to just relax a little and look forward to the remaining summer tournaments. The hard court season is just around the corner, and we'll be bringing you podcasts around that, of course. We say thanks to Melanie Bowes, our executive producer, for choosing the questions today and throwing a few in herself. Thanks to everybody who sent them in over the course of the last few days in order for us to do this show, and all Also, thanks, of course, to our other executive producers, Triple S, TennisBalls.com, our mascot, Charlie the Ferret, our other sponsor, the Manga Club, and we will be with you again very soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.